The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 27. Yunmen's the body exposed, the golden win, the pointer. Ask one, answer 10. Raise one, understand 3. Seeing the rabbit, he looses the falcon. He uses the wind to fan the flame. He doesn't spare his eyebrows. This I leave aside for the moment. How is it when entering the tiger's lair, to test, I'm citing this old case. Look, the main case. A student asked Master Yunmen, how is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall? Yunmen said, body exposed in the golden wind. The poem. Since the question has the source, the answer, too, is in the same place. Three phrases should be distinguished. An arrow point flies far into the void, over the great plains, chilling wind blasts, howling, wailing, in the eternal sky, intermittent misty rains. Haven't you seen the traveler sitting so long at Shaolin, who hasn't returned? Tranquil upon Bare Ears Mountain, a single gathering. So we are in our last week of Ango. This next week, on Monday, we start our last session of this Ango. And so this time next week, we'll be doing Shuso Hosen with Chike as the chief disciple, giving the talk and doing Dharma encounter with the Sangha. We've been studying karma throughout this Ango. If we are sincere in wanting to cease from creating harm and break unskillful cycles of really being a benefit, fulfilling what we might think of as our potential as Buddhas, then we really need to study and train in karma, in the mind, in the body, in the whole thing. And this training is, at every step along the way, helping us to develop very natural, already existing qualities that are present with all of us: mindfulness, patience, loving kindness, gentleness, courage, cultivating enough faith that we can have confidence in our practice of attaining and bringing forth peace and fulfillment without trying to control, to have trust enough to let go, and then let go still more. Here a student asks the great Master Yunmen, how is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall? And so here we have this timely image at this time in our own autumn, when the leaves are falling in profusion, littering the ground. And now a whole new landscape opens up as all of those millions and billions of paper leaves have fallen, are falling. What remains? To discover utter aliveness, we have to let go of life. And this can seem frightening, seem to go against our search itself. It's like we want to be in the full, verdant abundance of summer. But Thich Nhat Hanh, in Understanding Your Mind, talks about all the people who come to the northeast of the U.S. to see the fall foliage. And he says, but the beauty that they perceive and the extent of their own joy depends on the freedom and peace within their mind. In other words, people could travel from afar to be here and be in the midst of this glory and you not really be able to perceive it, not to be gladdened in their heart by the display. In teachings of Trungpa Rinpoche, he speaks about the qualities of a Dharma person, a Dharma practitioner, and that one of those qualities is being passionless, having passionlessness. And he says, having established the basic environment, having established the basic practice, we begin to pick up on all the little details of how we try to create our own local comfort zone. We see all the ways we try to make ourselves comfortable in the practice. Passionlessness means that instead of trying to create an overly comfortable situation for ourselves, we try and reduce that desire. Not so much the direct comfort, but the desire, the drive, that is sort of that leading, driving force that can sort of dictate what we do and what we don't do, what we take up and what we don't take up. He says this is an interesting theme for Westerners, where in the West we have all kinds of ways to occupy ourselves, from chewing gum to taking trips to the Bahamas. He says we're always looking for ways to solve our boredom problem. It's interesting. He talks about boredom. I've seen that come up quite a bit in his teachings. He talks about the boredom of meditation. I never really encountered meditation that way, but I think of boredom here in terms of dis-ease or quiet desperation or an ongoing sense of discontent. What do we do with that dis-ease problem, our discontent problem? Well, one of the ways we deal with it and that we're encouraged to deal with it is just to simply to distract ourselves from it. In a sense, act as though it's not there. And then it seems as though the problem will go away, but of course, it doesn't. He says, in contrast, passionlessness means experiencing that discontent properly and fully. In Western society, when any little irritation comes up, there's always some way to cure it. He says, we have not been taught how to deal with our boredom, our discontent, our dis-ease, or what he calls the levelness in our life. And so we're not able to withstand that discomfort, adversity, hardship. He said, when we're constantly following our passions, we always need some kind of sustaining power. Whereas with passionlessness, we're able to maintain ourselves. We can relate to that discontent, and we don't have to fill every gap. And so think of Zazen as being a very simple way to encounter all of this, sitting in this mountain form, in this body and mind, committed to staying on that seat, to not turning away, which can seem simple enough. It's easy to say those words, but in human experience, certainly within our culture, it's rather revolutionary. And in a sense, what happens on that cushion is we're introduced to our aloneness. You are alone in this world. No one can breathe your breath. No one can actually feel your sensations, can know your particular experience of sadness or joy, have these particular concerns that you do. That's yours. Mine are mine. So we are alone in that. And in Zazen, of course, that is one of the most frightening things that we want to try and stay away from. And so on the cushion, you're right there. It's right there, sitting on that mountain seat. No one is checking in on you, correcting, saving, praising, criticizing. So from moment to moment, rising and falling, holding on, letting go, it's you. It's yours. As it needs to be, as it is fundamentally, but we need to be in that place, holding the whole of that experience and the power of our ability to meet that in a different way. And so it's like entering into this state of solitude, of being alone. It's a lonely place. In a spiritual sense, it's a desert, a kind of wilderness. Perhaps there is no true spiritual practice without this. Many travelers speak of it from that very place. And yet, even in our aloneness, we realize we're not necessarily by ourselves. We're inhabited by hundreds, thousands of beings that enter into our mind. And every one of them has a desire, has a wish, has an urging, has something they need to convey to us, some direction they want us to follow in. They all have a mouth they want us to feed. In Understanding Our Mind, by that book on Yogacara teaching by Thich Nhat, he recounts the story of a philosopher, which is a sort of code for somebody outside of Buddhism, who asked the Buddha, "What do your students do all day long?" And the Buddha said, "They walk, they stand, they lie down, they sit, they eat, they wash their bowls, they sweep the floor." And the philosopher said, "Well, how are they different from anybody else in the world?" And the Buddha said that the difference is that these students do this within mindfulness, guarding their six senses. That's their revolution. They do all of these things, and often together, but they do them alone. He says, our suffering or our happiness lies in the field of feelings, sensations, which then lead to emotions and thoughts, images, memories. He says, mindfulness is the gatekeeper that guards our senses. And the teachings often speak of it this way, that all of the stimulation in the world are thieves that steal away our mindfulness, our stability, our clear seeing, our intention. He says, once we know how to use mindfulness to recognize these formations as they arise, then we know the direction we must go. We know how to meet them. We know how to practice. We may not even always do it, but we know how we can. We know that there is a pathway in front of us. He says, but there are internal knots and latent tendencies in all of us, and we've been speaking about this during the Ango. Blocks, he says, of sadness and pain that are tied up in our consciousness, in the deepest levels of our consciousness. Their nature is unwholesome. So when somebody says something, does something, looks at us in a particular way, we encounter something, then in the moment, there's sadness or there's pain or there's anger. And he says, when we experience that over and over again, it becomes an internal knot. And he said that the Chinese character for that term, that Sanskrit term, means to be ordered around, which I've always liked greatly because it's so appropriate, right? We're being ordered around, right? It's like we become subservient. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. It says these internal knots seem to make us do things without our even knowing it. That's without mindfulness. If we do it within mindfulness, we know that we're doing it, which is very different. It's like if you're making a choice to do something, going in a direction that you know is not an altogether good direction, know that you're doing that. Sometimes even to acknowledge to yourself, I am doing this or I'm not doing that, right? Not with the intention of changing your direction, right? It's not that there's some ulterior motive here, but actually just to take ownership of that action and just see what happens. How does that affect your inner landscape? He talks about all the various ways we're addicted, our attachments. And he says these don't happen in an instant, otherwise we'd notice them. He said they happen through repetition over and over and over again. And so they happen very subtly. We don't see them forming. We don't see those knots being formed. It happens stealthily, he said. But if we are guarding our senses, the doorways in, that the world streams in and that our desires arise and are sort of geared towards particular doorways, right? So they're desires that are sort of tuned to the visual, to sound, to taste, to touch. If we're guarding those senses, and this is not like a paranoia kind of thing, right? This is a wakeful kind of thing. It actually allows us to stop being paranoid. We can stop being afraid because we're mindful. We don't have to be afraid anymore. And these knots, you know, I think of them as, sometimes I think we think of them as, you know, sort of like cleaning a closet. It's like the closet everything goes into. You know, like everybody's got a junk drawer. Like all your other drawers are organized, not this one. Right? This one, you just throw everything in there, right? You know how to find it because it's all in there, but you got to search and do a search and rescue to get it because it's, there's so much in there, or there's a closet, right? And so we're going to, and so we're like that closet, right? And so we're going to go in and we're just going to very methodically, you know, very carefully, I can do this, just pick up one thing, each piece of paper, each file, right? Each ball of string, each piece of clothing, each hanger, each broken something that we were going to fix, but we're not. And just pick up each one and recognize it and then just dispense with it. Simple. But it's not quite like that, right? We can spend hours and hours doing that. Then we go in and we realize, wait a minute, I let you go. I threw you away. What are you doing back in here? How did you get back in here? Or we pick up something that seems very simple and there's this, all this stuff attached to it. Pick up one piece of paper and there's a shirt and a hanger and a baseball and a broken doorknob and yeah, seems to be no end to it. He says these latent tendencies are internal knots that have been partly transformed, so we think they're no longer there. I've taken care of that. It's as if we've cut down a tree, but the roots are still there, and so they sprout. Latent tendencies seem to remain underground. And there's so much profound teachings and understanding about this, and helps us to really understand why our own experience in practice is what it is. Right? Because without this understanding, we were just saying, everybody else seems to be doing fine, but there's something particularly problematic about this one. And we realize, no, this is the basic stuff of the human mind and consciousness, and is the basic stuff of practice. And so when we are practicing, when we calm the mind, right? So don't think of that as just letting go of distracting thoughts, but actually calming. And mind here is the whole thing. The whole thing. That's why we can't just focus on letting go of thoughts while the body is coiled like a spring ready to snap. Or that we're sitting in a way that is continuing to create a certain kind of tension or bundle that is not shifting. Right? We are not compartments, and we can't divide ourselves that way. We're not like that. And so the calming that is happening through the development of mindfulness and the beginning development of samadhi is dependent upon this whole system that is beginning to relax and rest in wakefulness, in awareness, brightly. And all of these other forms of practice that we engage in, following, doing the precepts and liturgy and establishing our intention every day, and all of these different practices, our body and our practice, are all working together in this one whole, unified, intricate, interdependent system that ultimately, in the teachings of Yogacara, is transforming at the base, in the place of these deepest tendencies, these deepest inclinations and dispositions. When we realize that ultimately and relatively, they have no own power. They don't have their own strength. They don't have their own will. They are not something or some things that are coming to visit us and torment us. So now, how can you hear this question? How is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall? The air turns cool, sunlight grows dim and weak, the sap ceases to flow, the leaves drop, everything pulls in, gathers in, a deep sleep descends in the dark, dark night sky. In the depths of your mind, when all the activity ceases. This is why in practice we have to consciously, in meditation, consciously let go of our many concerns. Which means to not bring them in and occupy ourselves with them. That's all that means. The important relationships, our various responsibilities, our essential questions, our concern about tomorrow, our regrets about yesterday, to actually just allow the whole world, the whole system to come to rest and to not actively be turning it and turning it and turning it. It's like preparing for Seishin, particularly for lay students, to prepare so that you can leave those concerns for the week, which means leave them aside in your mind. Because without that, meditation becomes just an ongoing activity. And we never actually taste, experience that mind that is your natural mind. And so we have to sit alone to go to that spiritually lonely place, enter into that desert. Many people have traveled there before, but each time you turn towards it, it's new. And we encounter deeper and deeper experiences of that. It's as though we've never been here before, and yet we've never been apart from it. And it has to be alone. You can't bring anyone with you. And if you can trust that in doing that, everyone ultimately will be taken care of. The footnote to that question, how is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall, is what season is this? When the family breaks up, the people perish. When the people perish, the family breaks up. And so an ordinary way of hearing this sounds all bad, right? We don't want the family to break up. We don't want the people to perish. Of course. This is a bodhisattva speaking, whose whole life is devoted to alleviating the suffering of others. So what kind of breaking up and perishing are we talking about? Is he pointing to? What gives one the courage? What gives you the courage, the trust, to have that degree of letting go? Losing our faith in samsara can help mightily. Becoming weary of the constant churning of the mind, that can help quite a bit. But ultimately, experiencing that solitude, that deep solitude, that deep mindfulness, that deep samadhi within yourself, then you know. Because it's not what you imagined. That's the thing. It's not what we imagine. I remember for many years when I was sitting on my own, thinking, you know, I'd be sitting and being very dedicated about doing that and thinking, okay, so concentration. There was a certain part of me that was like asking, so what? So I'm concentrated. All right, so what? But I wasn't really. So I was asking the question outside the door. But I was imagining what's happening on the other side of that door and coming to, so what? But I had to cross the threshold. And then we begin to see. Then all of these teachings begin to make sense. It's like, oh, why didn't you say so before? And Yunmen says, body exposed in the golden wind. The footnote to that says, he holds up the sky and supports the earth. He cuts nails and shears through iron, clean, naked, bare, purified, walking with even steps through the blue sky. Here, there's nothing to hide. There's nothing to obscure. If we think of this as a kind of vulnerability, which those words can evoke, body exposed. What kind of vulnerability is that? Vulnerability, you know, the word in our language means to be susceptible to physical or emotional harm or hurt. Well, no one wants that, right? That's why vulnerability is very difficult. No one wants to be hurt. We don't want to make ourselves vulnerable. right? To make ourselves susceptible to being hurt. In fact, so much of our those knots have been our own strategies to keep from getting hurt. And so we can be vulnerable in a way that makes us susceptible to being hurt by following our desires, right? By not being mindful, by not seeing or acknowledging or understanding what we're in the midst of, the direction we're following, the influences that we're digesting, by not understanding karma, right? By not fully respecting our delusion and its power. We can be vulnerable just within our own thoughts and emotions. I mean, Mara, right, is in a sense trying to make us vulnerable to ourselves so that we end up recreating cycles that cause harm to ourselves. That's why in the moment in all of the sutras where the Buddha or his disciples were encountering Mara and Mara was trying to do exactly that, in the moment when they said, oh, I know who you are, Mara's defeated. The body exposed is like your birthday suit before you were born. It's the birthday suit of your natural mind. Your birthday suit, you know what that means, is the suit you were born with. Your nakedness. So body exposed is like your birthday, the birthday suit of your natural mind. In this vulnerability, nothing is put forth, nothing is held back. There's no advance, there's no retreat. Body exposed. It's not an action. It's not something we've done. It's our basic nature. Buddhism teaches that there are three bodies of the Buddha. The Dharmakaya is your fundamental body exposed, free, nothing shrouding. The Sambhogakaya is the body of bliss, the body of reward. Sometimes it's spoken of that only deeply enlightened beings encounter the Sambhogakaya. We might think of it as enlightening practitioners, as all of the different ways that our lives transform through practice. Their Nimanakaya is the body of appearing in the world. The Buddha Shakyamuni was their Nimanakaya, a Nimanakaya appearance. And so this body exposed is this reality body. Right? And I was thinking about all the ways in which I, particularly in the early years of my training and for a long time, that I tried to, all my efforts to try and keep my teacher from seeing my own vulnerability, to keep from being vulnerable to him. I wanted him to see me all the way through so that I could see myself all the way through, but without actually making myself vulnerable, if you please. To try and be in control of how I showed up, what I presented, what he saw, what he experienced. And how, in a way, that just got more complicated for me. Because, of course, it was only in me. He was not confused about this. When I received Jikai, when I was ordained, when I became a senior, all of these stages of my training that I thought, oh, now it's even more important to be someone. That someone that I was creating an aniya, a kind of establishing a standard for. In the fulfillment of that role, not understanding that it was about the body exposed. Even experiencing the body exposed, still wanting to put something on to hide its nakedness. And how all of that was functioning in ways that were just beneath my consciousness. That would appear in moments and I would see, but then they would sort of slip back, go back into that closet, until it all just became untenable, or mostly became untenable. It this body exposed in the golden wind, a radiant wind and light of self-nature. In all places, at all times, it's never absent. That's why the footnote is displaying it all, holding up the sky and supporting the earth. Everything is present, and yet all the nails and shears are being cut through. Everything. The mountain crumbles and is level with the plain. Both sides. It's not a matter of thinking or not thinking, being active or still. In a way, this is our path, to continually be allowing this body to be exposed. What is letting go? What is letting go? What is non-attachment? What is trust and faith? What is relaxation in the deepest sense? What is trust? It is living more and more within this very body. You know, what really helped me in studying with my teacher, sort of trying to get over myself a little bit, was realizing at a certain point, at least with him, that if he hasn't seen what I'm up to, then he can't be a very good teacher. So like, what am I doing, really, anyway? Living a solitary path, sitting alone on this diamond seat. When the body is exposed, the more we let go, then really, truly, everyone becomes welcome. In a sense, to love, have a deep, abiding love for everyone and everything, and yet really not want anything in return. It's not a bargain. It's not a contract. I was thinking about how that solitary path, being alone, what is that like in our time? You know, we can't know what it was like in the Buddha's time or Bodhidharma's time or Dogen's time, but what about in our time? In our culture of constant stimulation, voices, 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 constant, talking, 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 and listen to me. Right? Adding to the cacophony. Contact, news, streams, images, all of it, activity, activity, activity. And while that grows, it seems to grow in direct and equal proportion to our isolation. So our natural and healthy sense of loneliness, of aloneness, gets obstructed by a kind of loneliness that is ultimately our estrangement from ourselves and then from each other. So little wonder that Jimon asked me if I'd gotten much pushback on my comment the other day about Facebook and virtual realities. And I said, no, I haven't. I said, probably people just completely disregard it because they know I don't know what I'm talking about. And I know that too. But it doesn't keep me from saying something. But I was thinking about virtual reality, which I know very little about, but just the idea of virtual, right? In a way, that makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense to be able to use our incredible vast intelligence and creating a world that is not so much this one, but is the one that we can create out of our own desires. What do you want it to look like? What kind of comforts do you want to have? What kind of discomforts do you want to be absolutely sure never show up in that world? In other words, your God. How's that going to go? Really? How's that going to work out? And so to be a practitioner means really to be quite clear being clear on an ongoing basis that this is your life. It's happening. It's not up ahead. And so to live in accord with your mind, to establish your intentions and live in accord with those intentions, and if you will be so bold to have vows and to live in accord with those vows, and then to protect that peacefully and fiercely to protect your Dharma path. And by protecting, I mean, don't put it at odds with anything. In a certain sense, we have to be disciplined. We have to actually practice, right? Otherwise, we're not. And that means very particular things, right? It's not ambiguous. It's not unclear. If we're going to be a practitioner, it means there are certain things that we really need to be doing in our life and other things that we pretty much need not to be doing. And we need to get clear about that. We need to get clear on what those things are. And it's not always going to be clear, so do your best and watch what happens next. And that will inform you. So we have to have that sense of discipline, of following through, of actually doing the thing we say we're doing. And then we also have to be pliant and flexible so it doesn't become rigid. Because then it becomes aggressive, then it becomes conflicted. And that's a very powerful thing, to have that clarity of this life. What do you need to do in this life? Not just for yourself, but actually for everyone. What do you need to be taking care of so that you can actually show up for others in the way that you really want to? And that requires that loneliness. It requires that aloneness. And there has to be time for that. It's not a, you know, just a poetry on a page. It's a real thing. You know, I just finished a couple days solo, which I try not always successfully to do every month before session. And I do that because I need that time of aloneness, of solitude, of unbroken practice, unbroken in the sense of where I can sort of chart the course of my path, of my practice during that period of time, specifically in solitude, so that when I'm within the Sangha, which is the great joy of my life, and I choose that, that both of those aspects are being continually cultivated, continually attended to, continually developed. And seeing when that's not in balance. The solitude is not isolation. It's so important to understand that. It is not creating distance. It is allowing us to see through the distance. It's what really allows us to be intimate without fear, to be compassionate without judgment, to be firm but without aggression, to be flexible but without ambivalence. You know, I've often said, I think of those guardian deities at the front of the monastery that are so fierce, right? And you have to run through their breaths of fire to get in. And in that, they burn off some of the flotsam and jetsam, just a little. And sometimes we have to be that fierce guardian. And again, in such a way that we are not establishing our practice against something, but actually embracing everything within that. Because it seems that the simple fact is if we don't establish that for ourselves, no one else can do that. And in that, there's a clarity, there's an energy, there's a I can't find the words. I think it's one of the many misunderstood aspects of Buddha Dharma. And not for no good reason, because we can see that inward turning of this practice, which is so essential, and not just for us, not just for practitioners, but for every living being. And I think it's the scarcity of that that plays a huge role in the mess we're in. That is not a part of our education. It's not part of our cultural values. It's not something we establish as a necessary part of our GDP or our way of doing business or whatever. And the thing is, if we don't allow it in some way in, if we don't have that those experiences, then the distance from that creates a sort of makes it irrelevant to us, makes it strange, which means we have really become strange to ourselves, which is not really a good thing. So I'll finish with a poem. Entering the dark night, yesterday's fear has passed. Waking to this day's bright, bright sky, tomorrow's promise is no longer enchanting. So many years of hope and worry, mountains of devotion to some other place. Body exposed in the golden wind, these autumn leaves fall without purpose, a final fading glory in accord with the winds of time. So let's, as we come together today, let's really enter into this last week of Ango, this 3 months of peaceful dwelling with our eyes open. And let's practice it well. These training periods are really, really important. They are a really important part of our training and our individual path. You know, these different practices that have come down to us, all so many, you know, there's virtually a teaching, a body, a banquet of teachings and practices for virtually any human experience we are having, have had, will have. But we have to sit down at that table. We have to avail ourselves. So, enjoy your afternoon, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.